What accounts for the very strong reaction of Russia to any kind of activity near its borders that Russian leaders might see as even a possible threat? University of Montana history professor Richard Drake has been looking into that question. He recently wrote an article for Counterpunch about the 1971 testimony of four American historians, Adam Ulam, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., William Appleman Williams, and D.F. Fleming, before a House subcommittee that wanted to hear their views about the origins of the Cold War and what course it might take as the Vietnam War raged on. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Drake about the testimony of the historians and how it relates to U.S. foreign policy today.
The Cold War, Russia, all that stuff. When I was reading your article, you were focusing on what's happened in the 20th century. And I'm thinking, is there something in the, the Russian habit of mind that goes back even further than that to the Mongols, to the French? Is it somehow ingrained deep in people who grow up there that they are vulnerable, that they can be invaded at any time, and that has formed their mentality for all these centuries?
The article to which you referred, David, appeared in Counterpunch, and it dealt with some of the reasons why Russia is unusually sensitive to the prospect of foreign troops massing on its borders, which is, of course, what they were facing with the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO, which was the intention of the United States as of 2008, the Bucharest summit meeting voiced by President George W. Bush. The article really took root from research I'd been doing on a book about William Appleman Williams, a revisionist historian of the Cold War. And as I conducted the research effort for this book, I discovered that Williams and three other historians, very famous historians, gathered in the House of Representatives subcommittee meeting on Europe, European affairs. This subcommittee meeting in 1971 met in order to hear what the leading historians in the country had to say about the war in Vietnam, which in 1971 was still raging, and what likely future developments would take place in the Cold War as a result of the war in Vietnam. Now, the other historians at this meeting who were there to testify and give their insights to the congressional leaders were Arthur Meyer Schlesinger Jr., a Kennedy advisor and consultant, liberal Democrat.
Part of the Brain Trust, yeah.
Yeah, part of the Brain Trust. Adam Ulam, who was a historian of Russia, very conservative, very supportive of American foreign policy in the Cold War, Harvard professor, and D.F. Fleming, a Vanderbilt historian, sort of on the left of center of the political spectrum in interpreting the Vietnam War and the Cold War. So these four historians each testified. This happened in June of 1971. Each gave an account. And as I was doing my research, I was most interested in Williams because he was the focal point of my book. But I was surprised to find how much more interesting, in some respects, the testimony of D.F. Fleming was, because he decided to take a deep historical look at U.S.-Russian relations as a way of framing his interpretation of how the Cold War unfolded and how where the Vietnam War figured in that context. And what he ended up doing with his time before the committee really kind of dominated the event, frankly, D.F. Fleming did. He said, look, in order to understand the Cold War and Vietnam, and indeed all the wars that have occurred since the end of the Second World War, it's really necessary for us to understand the psychology of Russia and why it has been so sensitive about invasions coming from the West. And he really gave everyone in the room, the fellow historians and the congressman, he gave them a historical lecture, really, on Russian history, really going back to the First World War. And he explained to them that the Russians have had a uniquely disastrous experience resulting from invasions from the West. And as I listened to what Fleming had to say, I, of course, kept thinking about not only the Vietnam War, which is what concerned the historians at that hearing in Washington, but I was also thinking about the war in Ukraine in our own day, and why the Russians might have been unusually sensitive, unusually concerned about the possibility of yet another invasion, adding to the collection of invasions that they've experienced. Fleming gave a marvelous overview of the catastrophes that befell Russia, beginning in 1915 when the Germans invaded in the First World War, and then following that, with the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the capitalist states, principally the United States and England, others as well, invaded Russia trying to squelch the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, they said, though, it was to bring Russia back into the war, right?
Well, yes, but
they amounted to the same thing, you think?
Yeah, they hated and feared Bolshevism. They knew what that meant. That meant a condemnation of capitalism. And so this was uppermost in their minds, to annihilate the possibility of that threat metastasizing and spilling beyond Russia's borders. But what Fleming did that impressed me so much was to show how these invasions, and then, of course, culminating with the Nazi invasion, 1941 to 1945, the catastrophic consequences of that invasion, he listed what they were. Some 15 Russian cities were completely destroyed. Hundreds of towns and villages, possibly thousands of villages, destroyed. Highways destroyed, businesses destroyed, an inconceivably large number of deaths. Some 27 million Russians died in that war. I mean, 27 million is a number that really beggars.
Hard to imagine living in a country that lost that many people.
It suffers that degree of bloodshed and destructiveness. And so what Fleming tried to get across, this marvelous historian, wrote a wonderful book on this subject, The Origins of the Cold War. And he didn't pinpoint the origins of the Cold War to be in 1945 or 1946 or 1947. No, the Cold War between the United States and Russia began in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution. And he tried to explain that if you want to understand Russian attitudes toward the West in 1971, you need to be aware of this backstory. And unfortunately, our leaders and our people are not aware of it. They have a very shaky understanding of what happened in Russia. And reading that testimony that was given in 1971, I thought, oh my God, this insight is as pertinent, maybe even more pertinent for 2024 than it was in 1971 for explaining Putin's reaction to the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO and having nuclear weapons, NATO's nuclear weapons on his own border. So that was sort of the context of the article that you referred to at the outset of your remarks.
And we also sometimes hear that when it comes to Ukraine in particular, Russian leaders view it as really, even though it's now a separate country, really view it as part of the heart of Russia, you know, that area around Moscow, yep. Belarus and Ukraine, that is, what would they call it, La Rus, you know, much more so than the rest of the country. I mean, that is like ripping out their heart in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
If you take,
I think all that's true. And in addition to the point you've just made, I think we need to be aware that in the western part of Ukraine, there's a large Russian population, ethnic population, Russian-speaking population.
In eastern
Ukraine, the Donbass region and along that area. And as a result of that fact and the mistreatment that they endured, those Russians in eastern Ukraine endured following the Maidan Revolution of 2014, CIA-inspired revolution in 2014, from that point on, the people, the Russians in the eastern part of Ukraine, felt victimized by developments for which the government of Ukraine was responsible. So I think all those factors combined to create a situation in Putin's mind, keeping in our own minds, remaining aware of this historical backdrop, going back to the First World War, a situation that he thought was an existential threat for Russia.
So the invasions that took place before the First World War and the Bolshevik Revolution, you would say are not as relevant?
No, I would say they're very relevant. In fact, I'm glad you raised that point because, again, referring to the Counterpunch article that I wrote about this matter, I added a section to that article concerning the work of Arnold Toynbee, British historian, very famous for his best-selling A Study of History. But in addition to that work, he wrote a short book in 1953 called The World and the The World and the West, and how the rest of the world, the non-Western world, views the West as the arch aggressor in modern history. And his book is sort of an addendum to the argument that D.F. Fleming made in 1971. What Toynbee, with his wide-ranging understanding of history, going back millennia, not just covering modern history, but going back to earliest times, he says, if you look at what has befallen Russia, not just considering the 20th century the way Fleming does in his presentation. Fleming only goes back to 1915. Toynbee says, you really have to go back to the 13th century, because beginning then, Western invasions became a fact of life for the Russian people. He then goes on to focus on the major invasions, beginning with the invasion of the Poles in 1610, the invasion of the Swedes in 1709.
Not the Mongols.
Huh. No, he doesn't address that one, but he said there were others that might have been listed in the among the others. But the French in 1812, and of course the Germans twice, 1915 and 1941. So what Toynbee adds to this historical picture of Russian sensitivity to border security, which is an obsession with the Russians, this is not just a passing political issue. It's the eternal concern because of what they've experienced for hundreds of years.
Well, a lot of it to do with their geography.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think Toynbee adds a very important dimension to this interpretation of Russian history as really a series of crises and traumas stemming from repeated invasions coming from the West. And I think Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, 2022 to the present, for as long as that horrendous war goes on, that war has to be understood in the same historical context. And it is not in the United States. I think our media...
It's simply a matter of the Russians violating the territorial integrity of Ukraine.
That's exactly it. And it's an interpretation that totally ignores history. It's only concerned with the political objectives, I think, of the United States, the foreign policy objectives of the United States, and there's absolutely no attention that I'm able to observe on American media, no attention at all paid to the Russian experience with invasions from the West, their fear of this and why they could not allow the situation in Ukraine to stand?
Yeah, I think it's more, there's more of the sense that look what they did after World War II. They took over Eastern Europe. Isn't this a repeat of that? That kind of thing.
That's another point. I think that D.F. Fleming, this historian from Vanderbilt, the author of The Origins of the Cold War, 1917 to 1960, that he emphasized in his testimony to the leaders in Washington in 1971. He said, look, you just have to understand that although what Joseph Stalin did in 1945, following the Second World War, imposing Russia's hegemony over Eastern Europe, although this in many respects was not right and wrong, it's understandable why he would have been, especially after losing 27 million people, losing 15 cities.
They did do the bulk of the fighting in Europe.
They did the bulk of the fight. They won the war. They were far more instrumental in defeating Nazi Germany than either the United States or the UK was. And so we really have to look at what happened after World War II from the viewpoint of the Russians and try to understand why that issue of border security was paramount to them, having just gone through this horrendously vicious war with Nazi Germany. Of course, they were going to say, no, we want no possible threat of that kind to materialize again. And I think that's just a focal point of Russian thinking in their dealing with their own foreign affairs.
And I imagine that's why there was opposition in Moscow to the reunification of Germany that Gorbachev agreed to.
Very much so. And this is why, in the context of that reunification and other issues, Gorbachev wanted to have assurances that NATO was not going to be moving toward the Russian border. And of course, we gave those assurances and then betrayed them. And I think the performance of American foreign policy leaders on this Ukraine issue has been extremely shabby. And we have a situation there culminating in this ghastly war that is still not over, resulting in hundreds of thousands of casualties and incredible destruction that should have been solved diplomatically, should have been solved before February 24, 2022, with some reasoned discourse on how do we provide assurance to the Russians that yet not another invasion is coming for them from the West, and meeting the security needs of the peoples along their border. There had to be a much more imaginative effort made there. Instead, what we did was to follow the Wolfowitz doctrine, which was really just to completely militarize American foreign policy. There will be no peer competitor allowed to emerge. This was 1992 when Wolfowitz presented this dogma, which has become a core element in American foreign policy thinking. And I think in order to understand why we insisted on pushing NATO to Russia's borders, you have to keep that Wolfowitz doctrine in mind.
This was part of the project for a new American century, or was
right.
It?
Okay. It was associated with that anyway. And this whole idea of following the Cold War ending in the early 1990s that, well, now that we're on top, we're going to stay on top. Well, the world is changing and we need to change with it and to understand what the best way is to maintain peace and stability in the world instead of promoting the exigencies of the American empire, which I think is the only thing uppermost in the minds of our leaders.
Yeah, it seems like it would take a much more enlightened leadership to break free of that.
But where is that leadership going to come from is the great question of the moment as this 2024 presidential campaign gets underway and we listen to what President Biden has to say, what his chief opponent, likely opponent, Donald Trump has to say. It's just all talk about the American empire in Gaza, in Ukraine. There's no real effort to promote peace. The only effort is to promote war. And this is a sickness. It is a sickness that is going to result in a threat to the world that may be unprecedented in magnitude and destructiveness. And this is why it's such a terrifying moment. The leaders in charge are incompetent. They really have an inadequate appreciation for history. They, I think, are caught in the toils of American imperialism. And this is driving the world into a dreadful corner. We're already there. I just hope we can find a way to escape from it.
And yet, because some of their opponents in the world are authoritarian, anti-democratic leaders, they are able to use that to suggest that these people are the ones who are causing the major problems. And if we don't oppose them, we are, in a sense, giving in to tyranny.
Well, that's the argument, but yeah. it seems to me to be a very unconvincing argument.
Apparently not to a lot of people.
I understand that. I understand that. But I think they're wrong, and I think they have to be shown to be wrong. If the world is to escape this constant spiral of war, revolution, and terror, which I think is becoming the dominant mantra of our time. I'm always mindful of this wonderful book that appeared in 2017. Has been very helpful for me in thinking about the world in which we live. It's Pankaj Mishra's book, Age of Anger, A History of the Present, and why the world is immersed in this epoch of mounting what he uses this wonderful French word of ressentiment, resentment, frustration, alienation. I think he really touched on the leading theme of our time in that book. I'm a great proponent of it and of his ideas that the world is really being victimized by a leadership class with no imagination whatsoever for peace. This is the war party in control. The war party is leading us off a cliff. And I think that book really helps us to see how the rest of the world, the non-Western world, is reacting to this. It's so interesting to me, David, that the global South, the world Pankaj Mishra is talking about in The Age of Anger, the global South has completely resisted the American policy of economic sanctions against Russia. It's reacted in an almost overwhelmingly negative way because they don't
trust.
And
it has opposed U.S. policy absolutely in Gaza as well.
Even more there, because the destruction in Gaza is the crime of our time. There's nothing more evil going on in the world than that right now. What's happening to the Palestinian people in Gaza? It's not just a war crime. It's a crime against the Holy Ghost. It's a frightening, horrible atrocity. And to hear our leaders defending that and trying to explain why we need to fund it and to arm the perpetrators of that assault on these defenseless people, women and children being bombed, these 2,000-pound bombs that we're supplying. This is Exhibit A for the case that the leaders we have are inadequate to the moment. They simply have not risen to the moral, intellectual, policy level where they need to be to preserve the world from an outcome that becomes more and more frightening every day. It's a hideous time.
It seems like the only positive development is the fact that even people in this country have shown their opposition to what Israel and the U.S. are doing. And that hasn't happened in such a big way that I can remember.
Well, I agree with you. I think that there is much evidence of dismay in America and resistance to the policy that we are supporting against the Palestinians. But unfortunately, the resistance and the dismay and all the moral protests that are taking place have not affected policy. The policy remains the same. The people are dying as they have been since this dreadful attack on Gaza began. And so I really link Ukraine and Gaza. In my mind, they're really two examples of the same problem. And it's a point that, D.F. Fleming makes in his testimony in 1971. You have to understand that what's happened in the world, that what's happened in American foreign policy since the end of World War II is that we really have been in the business of defending the Bretton Woods financial system that was erected in 1944 at that economic conference, where the International Monetary Fund was created, the World Bank was created. And that economic system is what we've been promoting worldwide. We've promoted it in Vietnam. We're promoting it in Ukraine. We're promoting it in all of our foreign policy military undertakings are connected with that. Another great historian, you and I have talked about him before, a man I admire infinitely, Gabriel Kolko. Wonderful. He died in 2014, but not before putting some powerful books up on the shelf. Terrific writer, wonderful historian. And in his various books that he wrote, he tried to show how you begin to understand what's going on in the world when you realize that one thread unites all of our wars. It's promoting this corporate capitalist system that was refined, developed at the Bretton Woods Conference 1944, and making this the global entity. That's the essence, the foundation of the rules-based order that President Biden is always talking about. And the question is that the order we really need? Is that the one we should be sacrificing all these lives for? Or do we need to rethink our system? Is the system itself, which is producing endless, unending income inequality? This is Pankaj Mishra in Age of Anger. Billions of people living on less than $2 a day. You wonder why there's terrorism and revolution and war in the world? The question is, why aren't there more manifestations of war and terrorism and revolution? The whole system is wretchedly wrong. And by promoting it and expanding it to the four corners of the globe, defending it against all comers, we've embarked on a crusade that is unworthy of us as a people. I think we have to rethink what we're doing, and our leaders need to be replaced. I think the foreign policy team that we currently have in Washington, the best thing that could happen to them would be retirement.
In the Vietnam era, there was so much protest that eventually it did get to Congress and they did cut off the funding. There was some action there, a little late.
This is true. But as those four historians I mentioned at the very outset of our discussion today, as they all agreed, all four of them, even though they were very different in their politics, in their reaction to American foreign policy, they all agreed that the Vietnam War was a catastrophe. All of them. The conservatives, the liberals, Williams was the one sort of Marxist there. But anyway, but then they all said this. This was 1971, long before the war was over. America really got involved in Vietnam in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. The Gulf of Tonkin episode occurred in the summer of 1964. And in February of 1965, President Johnson stepped up our military involvement there, bombing North Vietnam. And from 1965 to 1971, when this hearing took place with the four historians giving their views, they were saying in 1971, the war in Vietnam has been, and it was Arthur Meyer Schlesinger who actually said the words I'm about to repeat, summing up the consensus of the historians. The war in Vietnam has been a horrible and expensive education. We must have no more Vietnams. Well, we've been having nothing but more Vietnams ever since. And so this is why I think, I get as excited as any American about presidential politics. I'm very interested in this campaign and try to follow it as carefully as I can. But, you really have to get discouraged when you think about how little difference it makes in our foreign policy, whether a Democrat or a Republican gets in, because the foreign policies stay the same. They don't change. And they need to change.
Little slight tweaks here and there. I remember.
Yeah, tweaks.
Yeah. Carter emphasized human rights. A lot of it was Soviet bashing, but some of it was, you know, legit.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think you're right. And you offer me some crumbs of hope.
Right.
I mean, and I thank you for them. But the heart of the matter, I think, is on the negative side. The course of empire in American history is our great crisis. And we need to confront it. We need to understand it. So I'm writing this book about William Appleton Williams, who did understand it and tried to fight it his whole career with those wonderful books he wrote. Three of them in particular. I take a little bit of your time just to list the titles. The Tragedy of American Diplomacy. What a fateful title that was. The Tragedy of American Diplomacy. The Contours of American History. And one of my personal favorites of his, the last major book he wrote, Empire as a Way of Life. This is the real tragedy of the American people, which most of them don't even understand that we have an empire. And that's the first thing, is to be aware we have one.
I like the title of one of Tom Hayden's books, The Love of Possession is a Disease with Them, right? Yeah,
exactly. You know, that's what the 1,000 military bases worldwide are for. They're there to protect, defend the empire. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the right investment we should be making? Should we be spending $1 trillion a year on defense? Is the military industrial complex the right defining institution for America, which it has become? My argument would be no. And I think our greatest historians, starting with Charles Austin Beard, about whom I've written a book already, and his foremost intellectual heir, William Appleton Williams, both of those men said, no, the course of American empire will lead us to the same destination that every single empire in recorded history has arrived at, and that's defeat, destruction, and disappearance. That's where we're headed.
That's University of Montana Professor Richard Drake. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on February 12th, 2024.